todo el mundo.
But this was really
1981.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson, author of the Rock and Roll Nightmares book series and director of the documentary The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. This is your destination for all things rock, where the interviewees include musicians, authors, historians, filmmakers, and more. And now, on to the show. My guests today are Jeff and Stephen McDonald from the long-running California-based rock band Red Cross. They started at the ages of 15 and 11 in the 1970s, and they're still going strong to this day. They're here to talk about their brand new documentary, Born Innocent, The Red Cross Story. We'll also delve into women in rock, growing up Gen X, and they share their own personal rock and roll nightmares. We have Jeff on the line now, and Stephen will join us in just a couple of minutes.
Welcome to the show. I'm so happy to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I want to know how you and Andrew Reich connected, because it is his first music documentary, and he did such a fantastic job on it.
Andrew first reached out to Stephen, and, you know, and just kind of, because he'd seen Stephen on a podcast talk about his teenage abduction, which I can't get into, but it's featured in the film. And he was thinking about making a documentary about that. But then he thought, wow, their whole story, just Red Cross as a whole, would be an interesting documentary. So they asked me, and I was only interested in doing it if I was only just interviewed. Like, we didn't have to participate in the filmmaking aspect. And in order to do that, we had to really trust the person who was making the movie. And once we met Andrew, we instantly just became friends. We had so much in common that I just figured, okay, this is in his hands. And we would just meet up every several months and do interviews, they worked on a lot of the behind the scenes stuff, but it was 8 years.
Hi, I'm so sorry.
No problem at all.
I just answered the first question about how we met up with Andrew and Andrew's process and our process of trust and how we were able to turn it over to him to tell our story.
Sounds good.
All right. So, I had Andrew on my podcast a couple of weeks ago, and he mentioned that he just was going to take the reins on this documentary, and you both would just have to trust the process and trust him. I'm wondering if there were any surprises about what stories did or did not wind up in the final documentary.
Well, for me, I was a little surprised that the period during our hiatus, and what I had to show for myself for the time without Red Cross, the only thing he chose to include of my story was two audition rejections.
Of course.
But, and you know, Stephen successfully worked as a musician during that period.
Yeah, no, I was a producer too. In fact, if I'm going to brag for a second, I produced two records for Jack Antonoff, who's now ironically like the multi-Grammy award-winning producer himself. But
You were the mentor.
yeah, I guess he claims I was his first producer. That's what he produces Taylor Swift records now. He learned all that from working underneath me.
I love it.
Oh geez, wait, I was gonna say something else. Anyways, oh no, the other thing I was gonna say, but I understand he was telling a story, and I think one of the devices he wanted at that point in the story was to have the audience members rooting for these underdogs. So if he was telling some fabulous, well, Steve was living it up doing this, which I wasn't living it up necessarily, but I wasn't just fielding rejection after rejection necessarily. But so that was whatever. But that's just my ego. My ego can handle that, what I would say.
One of the things that surprised me, that was pleasantly surprised me, was my concern was like, how would the early years be represented in, on a visual level? Because we were late 70s, early 80s, people didn't have video cameras. People had only film cameras, and they were very cheap and who they shot, So I figured, wow, there's only four photographs of us from 1979 or whatever. But there was more stuff than I even knew existed, and it was really fun seeing all that. It was and also even that he found Andrew found our one of our performances from the classic LA public access show, New
Wave
Wave Theater,
Theater.
which was exciting.
So there was a bundle of surprises of like archival stuff that he put together. And yeah, like Jeff says, it's not like we have like a bunch of gray whistle test performances from 1980 out there. It's very underground and hard for anyone, people who were there, to find, much less someone who wasn't there, who's just researching it, doing like detective work. So
It's just a handful of photos and some memories.
yeah, but
Yeah,
he
well,
does
back then, I
well.
mean, remember you'd had to take your film to Photomat, and then you'd
Right.
find out that you maybe you had the thumb over the lens or something, and your pictures didn't come out. So it's amazing what he was able to gather, and it's almost like being an archaeologist. So I love that aspect
Totally.
of it.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what it is. I mean, it's fun being the subject of that, but it was also extra fun not having to do anything. I mean, we dug out what we could find as far as pictures and various things. And then it was like they did all the hard work.
I mean, that
So.
was the real trade-off, because it was like, yeah, I mean, just on the topic, back, not to backtrack too much, but on the issue of trust, because I did have the conversation with him early on where I was like, well, I get to approve of everything, right? And he's like, no.
I knew much better than
I was like, I
that.
don't get final approval. And he's like, no, because this is my movie and I'm telling the story my way. And then I realized, oh, right, that makes sense. And especially once I got the sense of, not only is it good that the subject isn't in control, because they're going to tend to try to make it too rosy. Also that he was doing so much work. And so he definitely earned the right to have the control and the say and the credit,
And
to.
we also, we by that time, after 8 years, we knew if there was something about that, we were just like, no, I hate that part. No. That he would have changed it. At that point, he would have.
Well, the only thing
But
that
it
I
didn't come up, thank
the
God.
only things that ever came up for me, like, because we did see an early cut, and there were just a couple of people that I was like, we can't have a Red Cross documentary without you including quote or two from this or that person. And he obliged, and he went back and watched interviews and stuff and found a clip that he thought helped push the story along.
Yeah, well, I was telling Jeff earlier before you joined us that I directed a documentary about the Ventures, and because that's
Oh,
my
cool.
dad, Don Wilson, and
Oh.
and Pleasant Gaiman is in my documentary as well, and she is a true historian, an icon, a character, a font of information. So I'm wondering, like, how did you first get to know Pleasant, and what did she add to Born Innocent, the Red Cross story as an interviewee?
Wait, can I speak first about
Please.
my memories of Pleasant Gaiman? pleasant game and sold us our first ticket to our first ever punk rock concert.
Oh, wow.
I remember this because I was super impressed with everybody at the Whiskey a Go Go in 1978 when I was 11 years old. And she worked the box office. And I remember being like really like amazed, like this punk rock girl behind the ticket counter. I remember this. It's just a weird memory that, and so our first concert, the first, we had gone to concerts in arenas or whatever, but first time we went to an actual club and got to see the upfront experience, and we went to a punk show, was at the Whiskey a Go Go. We saw X open for San Francisco band The Avengers, and Pleasant worked the box office. But that was many years, and then many years later, we became friends, and her band, Screaming Sirens, played with Red Cross.
They toured with us. They did a
Yeah,
tour
they
with
toured. Yeah, they did a California tour, I think, with us. And yeah, and she's, always, she's been writing in Los Angeles for years. And yeah, she was part of the original LA punk scene, and part of that generation that we looked up to and admired so much getting into local music.
Well, I'd love to go into that a little bit deeper. Who are some of the women in music that you've looked up to over the years or been inspired by or influenced by?
Well, that's pretty easy. I mean, with the original LA punk rock scene, there were a lot of women involved, and they were, we admired them. We like Diane Chai from the Alley Cats was like, our incredible bass player. And we loved Alice Bag and Pat Bag and Charlotte when she was in the Eyes, the Go-Go's. I mean, LA was just a rich, was rich with women musicians, and it was very cool because we come from the era where it was a very novel. It was like a novelty to see a girl with an electric guitar. Like when I first saw Susie Quatro perform, it was like, wow, a girl with an electric guitar. It was so foreign and so exotic. But then by the time the LA scene happened after the Runaways, it just became normal, and it was great. And so many of the most interesting people on the scene and most talented ones were women.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like it was kind of a non-issue. I mean, I
Yeah.
suppose like once the Go-Go's like broke through to mainstream, then that was a big deal. That it was the first all female band that wrote their own songs for, completely in control of their own situation, and that had a number one record, and so I guess the mainstream world kind of viewed it as still a novel thing, but in this little cocoon, that little LA punk rock scene that we first got to participate in starting in 1978, it was just a given that there were almost as many women on the stage as there were men, or at least the shows that we went to.
A lot of the more interesting characters were women. And and for us, it really, the LA punk scene really started with the Runaways' first album. It's like, the local LA teenagers, girls, aggressive rock and roll. And, they were the band that inspired so much of the first generation of LA punk rockers. And we were lucky enough to discover their album when it came out. So women have always been like a big deal in Los Angeles
But I
for
mean,
musicians.
and I'd also like to think that it's like, I feel like in that scene, it wasn't so like it was already progressed to the point where they were just bands. It wasn't like a chick
Yeah.
band or whatever. It was.
After the Runaways shocked the world. Yeah, then by the time we started discovering local groups, it was totally normal just to have like a girl bass player or someone, a girl not necessarily being the center, being a supporting character or the lead, like Alice Bag.
Yeah, like I've always thought it was weird. Like for some reason in the mainstream, it still is a thing, And like I think about like how like Billy Corgan, every time he would have a new bass player, it would always be a woman, and it was almost like, and in fact, that's one thing we talk about in the film because I auditioned for his band and I
And
didn't get
you
it,
weren't woman
and
enough
then
for Billy Corgan.
eventually had Paz playing bass in that band, and it's almost like I mean, it's great giving work to whoever, but in some ways it almost feels like, what about just thinking of all of us, just like as musicians, women included, you know? And somehow, oh, it's almost like he's like there was some kind of, I don't know what the word would be, but
I don't know, diversity
yeah,
checklist,
exactly,
I
or
guess.
something. And it's just like, or that women play differently or something. And it's just like, okay, well, I guess that you're putting in a positive light, but you're also just not, it's somehow it's not equal somehow, and it bothers me, you know? And that's how, because we just have always, like, you know, when the Go-Go's got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I remember I did a little post about it because I had been advocating for a while. I just thought it was absurd that they weren't, hadn't been acknowledged. And so when I finally did, I made a post and I said, you know, perhaps the best band ever from Los Angeles, you know, aside the Beach Boys. And I just thought it was like Beach Boys and Go-Go's, just two great LA bands. And you know, because people kept talking about all women, and it's like, whatever, they're just a fucking band, you know, great band, stood on their own as songwriters and players and, you know, just, you know, whatever, just all the things that a band is. And so, yeah, I get it. Like the diverse, there's, you know, and I realize there's still a lot of sexism out there, and that women probably still walk into Guitar Center and get, have to like cut through the skepticism from the sales dude who is like, is this for your boyfriend or whatever crap? It's like, you know, and I get it, but I mean, I'm still like, I'm already in the future. Like, I feel like we already saw the future back in the late 70s where everybody just kind of in that world just it didn't matter. None of that mattered. And I loved it, you know, and hopefully the rest of the world will catch up eventually.
Well, I want to go into an aspect of the documentary that I really loved because I feel like even if a viewer is not very familiar with your music, they will still get an entertaining story and also something out of it, particularly for Gen Xers. And there's Jimmy's Fantasy, the song remains the same homage. And I remember being a kid and going to see that at the midnight movie every week in LA. And there's a lot of things like that are just cultural that I think stand out. What are some of your favorite moments from each of you from that aspect in the film?
Well, the only thing I'd say, well, first off, I just reiterate, I it's one thing I am grateful the way Andrew told the stories. I do think it's a great primer for people who know nothing about our music. And I know that he had somewhat of like a mainstream ambition or an ambition to spread the word to people that know nothing about us. And I'm glad to hear you affirm this, that it's a compelling watch, even if you know nothing about our music. So, I'm grateful for that. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just think it's funny. I mean, for instance, like in the story, in the first act, there's this terrible story about I was sort of abducted by my girlfriend and I was gone from, and we don't need to give too many spoilers or whatever, but it was sort of a cautionary tale about being too young in the environment and it all worked out, but then, like, it's so this heavy moment. So you're going from having this fun thrill ride of, you know, of these little kids playing in a punk band, and then there's this heavy moment so early on, and it's like, well, where do you go from there? And then suddenly we're taking a swan dive into the television that we grew up with, and we start wanting to do embrace things like we're a garage band. Like the Partridge Family, you know.
Which would make, you know, the Greg Shaw people and the hardcore like Rollins people very confused.
And we start referencing these things, and we go and we make our next album, our first full length album. We had already made a debut EP at that point, and our first full length is named after a television movie. From the 70s that had a big impact on us. The Linda Blair film about teenage delinquency called Born Innocent, which ironically is the same name as the documentary.
How ironic.
And coincidentally or not so coincidentally, but and in many ways it's interesting that, like, because we're processing what had happened to me the best we can with the tools that we had, which were somewhat limited, and but we're getting along, but we're like, it's hard. And as you can see in the interviews, the current recent interviews with our parents, they're still processing it. It's still a difficult subject to talk about. And yet Jeff and I are making an album inspired by a television mini television movie about teenage delinquency that in some way we kind of relate to because of what I've just gone through.
Yeah, we
And
never actually. Oh, yeah, because you eventually ended up in juvie hall. But I'm like we had we were living vicariously through like television stories of teenage
well,
delinquency.
also in the Runaways, Dead and Justice song that closes the first album. And
Yeah.
it's like, these are all these things that we kind of like, we're mesmerized by these concepts, yet we were just kind of viewing it as outsiders. But then suddenly I got very close to this kind of, dealing with these big institutions. And like, I had a parole officer at 13 after that incident. And so, and it's just interesting that in the film, well, it's funny the way he shifts the mood into that, because it's a hard, there's a hard, I mean, I think for in classic storytelling, you would save that story for like the third act. But so we shift gears, but that's what happened in real life. And in real life, we just took a swan dive into our kind of pop culture escapism land.
Which
And
you know, which we the kids our age, we were basically brought up on television, and a lot of and a lot of the people that our peers were trying to deny that part of their past, and we embraced it. I mean, obviously, with a knowing nod to the how ridiculous it was and how it actually did rot a portion of our brains, but we were able
well,
to exploit
you
it.
know, it's the afternoon special movie or the after school special, or we
Yes.
had those, a Born Innocent or Sarah T. Portrait of a Teenage Alcoholic and
Yes.
Dawn Portrait of a Teenage Runaway and all those movies that I think were quite dark, which
Yes.
certainly speaks to that 1970s ethos, I guess, of kids
Right.
growing up much faster than they probably should have.
Definitely. I remember seeing it wasn't an after school special, but the first one in that kind of genre that I saw that was I thought it was extremely cool but extremely horrifying was Go Ask Alice.
Oh, yeah.
They turned the book Go Ask Alice into a movie of the week, and that was early 70s. And I have since rewatched it, and it's very, very heavy, and also features a really great cameo with like a 13-year-old Mackenzie Phillips.
Oh,
Oh,
wow.
yeah. She
Yeah.
plays main character. Go Ask Alice. She was like a girl. She hooked up with all these like
No, I know.
rock and roll kids and got
I
into
asked
drugs.
who played Alice.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. She was not like a known actress.
And that was also the era of Looking for Mr. Goodbar and just all those
Right.
really dark subjects.
Yeah, the cautionary tales of, young, vulnerable, and those are females that we're talking about.
Yes.
We were little kids too, as we kind of identified with these situations, but we willingly put ourselves in some of the, we thought we were safe or whatever, but so
Absolutely. That was
weird.
a different era, with the groupies, the teenage 13-year-old groupies hanging out with Jimmy Page, and people today don't really understand how that was pretty acceptable back then.
Well, from where we came from, we didn't have access to that stuff being, landlocked in Hawthorne. But, like early rebels in our peer group that I think that I, and but I can speak for both of us, we both looked up to was like Tatum O'Neal and Paper Moon. Being like a kid our age who's like cursing and smoking cigarettes. And that was like,
And
that was
grifting.
an early inspiration.
Yeah, I want to get back to the music now
Okay.
because
Okay.
understand that most of your music is original, but you have covered everyone from Charles Manson to Cousin Serena. I mean, you really run the gamut. Do you each have a favorite cover of yours? And can you talk about the inspiration behind it?
Well, a cover from like we've done them throughout, throughout our career, and most of them have been issued on either like our Teen Babes from Monsanto record, which was all covers, or later on we did a collection called Hot Issue, which had some of our cover songs on. I really personally like the cover we did on from our last the album before the last album, The Party, the theme song from the movie, the 1968 movie, the
Okay.
Henry Mancini song, and that was like an unusual song to cover, but it turned out really good.
We've been using it as our walk-up music at our shows. It's
But Henry Mancini had a part in our early getting together and writing songs, because Stephen was in the school orchestra and they learned things like Peter Gunn and stuff like that on. And so when he wrote the original bass line to Annette Scott the Hits, it was very inspired by Henry Mancini.
Down, 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 down,
Yeah, so it was,
down,
it's like we were
down,
like,
down,
I think that made us already like a little bit more sophisticated than our peers at the time. We had classical influences.
So one cover I would say that I've always loved that we used to do in the 90s, but and I don't think we've ever recorded it, but we used to do a Jonathan Richman song called Summer Feeling or That Summer Feeling. And it's just this beautiful little sentimental tune that I thought Jeff sang beautifully. And on a good night, it would really hit in a way that it would make me tear up. And so
Ah.
throw that one on.
Oh.
Oh, that's nice. Now, I want to talk about another theme that runs throughout your documentary, which reminded me of Spinal Tap, all the drummers. So tell me, who is the drummer in Red Cross now?
Well, we've been playing with Dale Crover of the Melvins for the last 7 years, I think, or
Oh, okay. All
so.
right. Wow. Lasted a long time so far.
It's almost healthy. And I play bass in the Melvins as well. So Dale and I have been sort of been a rhythm section together for I've been playing bass in the Melvins in nearly a decade now, and he's been playing with Red Cross for about 7 years. Dale had a back surgery last year, so he didn't end up playing on the newest album. We used Josh Klinghoffer, who also was the producer on the record. So we had a little bit of the Spinal Tap thing where we had a different drummer on the record, I guess, or on the movie they show Josh because he's playing as we're doing the title track, Born Innocent, and Josh produced that song and played drums on it. And there's a little joke where it says like drummer number 88 or something along
Right.
the
Why
line.
do you think that is kind of a cliche and yet a truism in
Well,
rock
I
music?
think what it is with drummers, like teenage drum people who are like, they understand the power they have, because it's impossible. I mean, to find a good drummer is really hard, because not everyone who plays drums are good. And since they're the actual foundation, they decide whether you're playing too fast, too sloppy, too slow. If you find a good one, you're kind of at their beck and call. So I think that it's early power trips by some of the people we knew. But we're still friends with most of our former drummers. We still work with some of them occasionally. But it's a power trip for them. They don't get all the attention to the public eye, but they hold a lot of the cards when it comes to being a functional band.
I like that answer. That's very well thought out and certainly
Well,
born of experience.
lives. You'll be lived it.
What is your own personal rock and roll nightmare?
Well, a rock and roll nightmare that we were able to avoid was one that a lot of our peers didn't. Like we were thinking about the group Black Flag. The first time they toured England, they didn't have any plans and they just met skinheads and they stayed in squats. And Steve and I were just in London. We're like, wow, how do we avoid never having to go to London and do a tour and then have to stay in squats with punk rock squats. That was a nightmare for me. We used to call them in America punk rock crash pads. A lot of bands would go on the road and never get hotels, but just whoever they met at the gig, they would stay at their house. So we called them punk rock crash pads. And we avoided punk rock crash pads for the most part too.
But I mean, I don't hold that against anybody who's because you get, it takes a
But
lot
it's
of,
a nightmare that it's a nightmare we avoid.
it's impossible. It's really hard to make any money on the road. And luckily there are crash pads out there available for people
Available.
who need them. Luckily, we've been able to avoid them. That was
Right.
always my thing. I don't want to sleep next to someone's cat box. And then for me, it's like my rock and roll nightmare is it's always technical difficulties on stage. I hate that moment. I absolutely hate it. And just last night I was re on stage in San Francisco and I was recounting our very first show in San Francisco. And
At the Mabuhay Gardens.
one of the most difficult technical difficulties a band can have on stage, we experienced at our very first show on the very first note, which was the kick drum beater went straight through the kick drum head on the first note.
No.
So the very
Oh my
first
gosh.
note, you lose your beat.
And we have no roadies, no extra
And
pads.
but even if you have roadies, that's a very difficult one to change because a kick drum is usually attached to the toms and it's all buried in all the different drums. It's really hard to swap out the kick
It
drum
is one of the worst things that could
or
happen
to
to a band.
change the head. It's next to impossible. So take a couple of, like, I was probably 13 and our drummer was maybe 17. Like it was, so I have all the, and so then you get this jolt of stress hormone that enters your body at this moment and everybody's watching you and you had all these expectations and ambitions for the way the night might go. And you hope for the best, and then immediately your expectations are just like vanishing, and you have to go immediately into problem solving, and you're hoping that the crowd doesn't walk away, blah blah blah. So that would be my personal rock and roll nightmare.
Wow. I know. I know. I mean, I feel exactly the same as Steven, but he's even more intense about it because I noticed our last show we played in San Francisco, he unplugged his bass a few times, and I just saw it, and I'm like, oh my God, poor Steve, he's probably tripping out
Now,
because
that was
I saw
easy.
that you had unplugged it and you had it. Yeah, I noticed you before you had that split second before you realized where why your bass wasn't working.
Well, it
I mean.
happened quickly. No, well, yeah, I kicked the cable out of the box on accident. I'm out of my tuner, and no, I was just annoyed because it happened at a point in the show that I always really enjoy. And but I looked down and I could see my eyesight, luckily, is still pretty good, and I could see easily that I had kicked the cable out of the box, and it was just a matter of me finding the tip and inserting it back in. So it was fine.
Well,
The problem is when everything looks fine and you're like, but it's not working. Oh no. So whatever.
right.
Technical
Yeah,
difficulty.
we were able to solve that problem. Well, you just got back from a tour, so I'm sure you're taking a break for the holidays, but when can we look forward to seeing you guys on the road again? And when is the movie out?
Well, the movie is screening in like select theaters starting in December.
The
And
first week of December.
what's that?
The first week of December.
Yeah, so I mean, and I don't know all the dates. I only know the Los Angeles dates right now, which there's December 5th at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood, which is exciting. And then it's playing in Santa Monica and
Lovelies.
Hollywood on the 10th and the 11th. I don't remember which. By the way, people are going to have to just, I think it's redcrossfilm.com is the place to go to get all the info. I know there's also a screening in Phoenix on December 6th that I'm going to go to. And all the ones that we've mentioned, we'll be at and we'll be doing like Q&As and stuff.
Oh,
And
great.
yeah. And then but I think there's more coming in other places. And so you just go to those listings. And then as far as live shows, we're not exactly sure when our next live shows are, but there will be shows in 25 and then definitely in 26. And I should also mention that our new book, our memoir, Now You're One of Us, The Incredible Story of Red Cross, I just saw is unfortunately the first pressing's already sold out, so people are going to have to wait till after the holidays. So,
Oh, okay, and is it on Kindle too, like an
well, it's
ebook?
available on
Kindle.
Kindle. Hang on,
Kindle.
it's available on Kindle, but the thing I was going to say, well, Amazon now posts that there's a wait for it, and I have the intel. We're
Okay.
basically like, unless you can find a small shop in your town that has some copies, it's hard to find. But we're the number one punk book on Amazon.
Yes. Congratulations.
Yeah, punk book. We're number one. We're number one above Jesus and Mary Chain and Rebel Girl, Plain
Fantastic.
Hannah's book.
Love it. Well, that's
But
another one to add to my
unfortunately,
list.
people could only pre-order the second pressing now. But we
Yeah.
encourage them to do that, and it be arriving in January.
All right. Well, that's fantastic. And are you guys on social media? Where can our listeners find and follow you?
Sure. Well, Red Cross is on Instagram at just REDDKROSS. I actually have the Stephen McDonald account on Instagram. I guess I was early. That's with a V. Jeff is Jeff RK or something,
No,
or
I think I'm Jeff McDonald
RK.
official or something. Or is it RK?
You
Well,
have
if you
RK,
just
yeah.
do a Jeff McDonald, you'll find me in Instagram and Facebook
So we
and
do it because we do our own, we do Red Cross related stuff on our own stuff. And then we're on Facebook, just Red Cross. We haven't delved into the world of TikTok yet.
Oh, I have. I've
Oh,
been on
Jeff
TikTok for
has.
a while. Yeah.
Jeff's
Oh
our
my gosh.
resident TikToker.
So just look for Jeff McDonald and see if the picture matches my face, and then you'll know it's probably official.
Yeah, so you
All
can find
right.
Jeff doing Britney Spears lip syncs on TikTok. Kidding.
Well, Jeff and Steve, thank you so much for being on the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast, and congratulations on your wonderful film and your number one book. Really happy for you.
Thank you very much.
You.
This concludes another episode of the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Remember, there's a book series too. All the books are available in paperback, ebook, and audio via Amazon or the Rock and Roll Nightmares website. That's ROCK-N-ROLL-Nightmares.com. Our official theme song is She's Out for Blood by Fuzzbuster, founded by Lars Cabot. Thank you for listening.
Well, she's by